There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway, what's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Now, Peter James is quite a household name, but for anybody who isn't familiar with his work, here's a little bit of information about him.
Peter James is one of the UK's most treasured crime and thriller novelists. His Roy Grace detective novels have sold over 80 million copies worldwide. His first non-fiction title, Death Comes Knocking, was published in 2016. Three of James's books have been adapted as critically acclaimed plays. He's also produced numerous films, including The Merchant of Venice, starring Al Pacino. He was chair of the Crime Writers Association twice and won the Diamond Dagger Award for sustained excellence 2 years ago. James was also voted by WH Smith readers as the best crime author of all time. Born and brought up in Brighton, he divides his time between his homes in Sussex and Notting Hill in London.
The Al Pacino comment reminded me of a fun fact about Peter James.
Go on then, what's your fun fact, Annabelle?
I can't remember. He's got
you can't remember
of,
it.
He's got lots of animals, and I can't remember whether it's alpacas or llamas he has. I think it's llamas, but one of them is called Al Pacino.
Do you know what? I didn't know that he'd produced Al Pacino?
Yeah.
That's my fun fact of the day.
I like the llama bit better, or okay, alpaca bit, whichever fact it actually is.
It should be an alpaca, Al Pacino, surely.
I never realised. Oh my goodness, I feel really blonde now. Okay, we're going to move on. We're now going to transport you to the island. Peter has just told me that his first book will be The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris, and I've just asked him to describe experiencing Harris' original telling of the story versus the film version that many listeners like myself might just be familiar with.
I'm always an advocate of trying to read the novel before seeing the movie, because the moment you've seen the movie, then whoever is cast in that film is forever embedded in your mind. Now, it can be not always a bad thing. I think the performance of Hannibal Lecter in the movie is just utterly mesmerizing. And I think Anthony Hopkins is forever emblazoned in my mind. But I remember years ago having a great pleasure and honor of meeting Elmore Leonard, who's another of my heroes. We were at a dinner at a festival in Italy, and I said to him, you know, I really love all of your books, but I don't think the title of it, the one number which...
Get Shorty?
Get Shorty. I said, you know, Get Shorty is probably my favorite war, but I can't get John Travolta out of my mind as Red Hot Chili Pepper. And I remember Elmore kind of gave me this kind of wry smile. He said, you know, I have a different kind of a problem. Every time I meet him, I can never think of anything to say to him. It made me laugh. But and to me, Travolta was not that character. But in Silence of the Lambs, it was. But I think in general, the great joy of reading is to imagine the characters. And for me, so often movie adaptations then are a big letdown. But in the case of Silence of the Lambs, it really wasn't. I think Jodie Foster was a wonderful portrayal of Clara Starling. I can't think of any actor at that moment in time who would have portrayed her better. And even the guy who played Jamie Gumm, I can't remember who the actor was, but he was like just wonderfully creepy. When I read the novel, I was on holiday in Phuket with my then partner, and I was lying in bed reading it about 11 at night, and there was a bit when Jamie Gumm's kind of the senator's daughter's kidnapped, and she's at the bottom of the well, and realizes that she's been captured by this guy who's going to skin her. And I think I had nightmares all night.
Not surprised. I had nightmares after watching the film, but I do wish I'd read the book now. One of the lines from the book, if we go back to the book very briefly, directed at Agent Starling just before she goes to meet Hannibal Lecter for the first time, is, "You're to tell him nothing personal, Starling. Believe me, you don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head." And that got me wondering how you approach getting inside the heads of the characters in your own books, particularly the villains. You even won an award for Scariest Villain at one of the crime writing festivals, I believe.
Yes, I am fascinated by villains, and one of the ways is that I do quite a lot of talks in British prisons. I'm very involved with a charity called the Reading Agency, and a terrible indictment on the education system in this country that the average reading age of 50% of prisoners in UK prisons is below 11 years old. So I do talks in prisons trying to encourage people to read, and it really does makes a difference. But what I get out of it, in addition to that, is the opportunity to meet with these villains. And, you know, I've given talks in fairly high security prisons, talking to murderers and even kind of mass murderers at times. And I find mixing with them and just kind of being in their company, and, you know, and they'll open up. And I've had some amazing insights. I mean, I think the classic I ever had was a woman villain that I created in one of my Roy Grace novels, Love You Dead. And she was like a black widow who targets rich elderly guys. And this was inspired by a woman I met in a woman's prison about 5 years back. And I was giving a talk, and she was really asking smart questions. There was this woman there in the audience. She was about in her 50s, asking really smart questions. And I thought, oh, I wonder what you're in for. You're clearly, she's asking me about Thackeray and Dickens, and they're clearly well-read, educated. So I'm kind of fascinated with what's brought her in here. And I get to mingle at the end of my talks, and I go up to her, and I said, oh, you know, I never say, what have you done? I just said, how much longer do you have to go? She sort of looked at me and sort of glared, and she said, 9.5 more bears, and it's just not fair. There's a woman did exactly what I did in London. She's only got 6 more years to go. I said, oh, you know, what brought you in here? She said, well, I poisoned my mother-in-law, the old bag. I'm like, what? And she said, well, the thing was, she went in the hospital to die, so I embezzled her bank account. And the woman didn't die. She came back home. I realized she'd find out what I'd done, so I had to poison her. But then I realized my husband would find out, so I poisoned him too. And it's just not fair, the length of my sentence. And I was leaving the prison, I said to the officer taking me out, I said, is that woman for real? I said, absolutely, sir. Husband was 3 months on life support, he's got permanent brain damage, and she's just angry about the length of a sentence. You know, I'm fascinated by, really, I mean, many things about kind of killers in particular, but I think what fascinates me most of all is, what is that difference between the person who kills and you and I, anybody else, so-called normal, and it's often not that much of a difference. That's, I think, the creepiest thing of all.
The creepiest thing of all, indeed. That was Peter James with his first Castaway book, The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris, who, by the way, is the author I mentioned earlier who hasn't given an interview since 1976. He's probably the definition of a recluse.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, you've actually read Peter's latest book, Need You Dead, haven't you?
I have.
I've just started it.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask you, because I know you're a bit of a crime fiction fan, there's all sorts of different crime fiction novels, and we've got quite a few different authors coming to the festival. So you've got your kind of psychological thrillers, you've got your whodunits. Is there one that you're more of a fan of? Or do you like them all?
Yes, I like them all. I do enjoy, somebody who's not coming to the festival this year, but has been to the festival, Anne Cleves, the Vera books, and also her Shetland series. And I think in those, what I probably like best, and also in Peter James's, you've got the accurate police procedural stuff. And you've also got a detective figure that you really get involved with. And sort of personally, Mark Billingham's are the same, where you really are rooting for the main character, the main detective character. Those are probably, so I probably enjoy a series where the character develops, where the police character develops. So Ian Rankin's, all those where you actually follow the progress, and it's not just blood and guts and murders and things like that. Yeah.
You mentioned accuracy. I think that's an important point to bring up when talking about Peter James, because he is a stickler for research. He mentioned it when we were chatting, that research is up there with like the top three most important things about writing a book for him. And it's clear when you read it that he's meticulously researched it. And when we were listening to that, you know, he even goes into prisons and he talks to the prisoners to try and get under the skin of these criminals. Mm. And that really shows in the books, I think.
Yeah, and he works really closely with the police force where he lives as well. So he goes out on patrol with them and things like that. So he definitely does his homework.
It's like, have you ever seen Castle?
Yes, I have. Yes,
so
I have.
I always think of Peter James a bit like Castle.
Yes. Yeah. No. What? Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
He is, of course, coming to the festival, and just to let you know, that's on Saturday, the 10th of March at 10 a.m. You can catch Peter. He'll be talking about his latest book, Need You Dead, and also some other books as well. One that he's writing at the moment, and that will be out in May. So, if you want all the details early, you can go to the session and find out. Now, very briefly, the thing about the meticulous research, and one thing I noticed in Need You Dead was the fact that when he was describing how police procedure changed following the Brighton hotel bombing in about, was it 1984?
Yes. When
confirming the whereabouts of gentlemen who'd been staying in the hotel, they ended up phoning their wives.
That's right.
And it caused a number of divorces.
Indeed.
I thought that was, you've got a lot of interesting historical tidbits like that about Brighton throughout the book. So if that's the kind of book you like, I'd recommend it as well.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So Peter James, we've left him on the island. We've been a bit mean. We've gone away and had a cup of coffee, and Peter James is still stuck on the island, Yvette.
Oh, is he? Oh dear.
Don't sound very sympathetic at all. It's probably quite a nice island. He's on a holiday, really.
He better just get himself here for March. That's
exactly.
I don't care where he's at the moment, actually.
So the first book that he shared with us was The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris. And it's time for his second desert island read. So just to remind you that Peter James is appearing at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature this year. But all these credentials of his, best-selling crime author, seller of millions of copies of books, will not be enough to save him from the desert island. The Silence of the Lambs was the first book. Now, the second book that he's talking about is Brighton Rock by Graham Greene. Have you read it, Yvette?
I have. I read it years and years ago. Every time these books come, like, must reread that. I'm going to have to live till I'm about 132 at least to fit all this in, along with all the new books. But yeah, Brighton Rock was a goodie.
Now, speaking of Brighton, before we listen to Peter James' second desert island book discussion, could you give us a little question, a brain teaser?
I could. So we're playing for bragging rights. So let's see how many of our listeners can tell us which UK, which English county is Brighton in. So that's my question. You need to text in to 4001. Mm-hmm. Tell us your name and tell us which county you would find Brighton in.
In the meantime, here is Peter James telling us about his second desert island choice, Brighton Rock by Graham Greene.
I first read Brighton Rock when I was 14 and living and growing up in Brighton, where the book was set. And Graham Greene's Brighton Rock, in a sense, a bit like the two books that I think have been the biggest game changers in crime fiction are Silence of the Lambs, Brighton Rock before it. Where Brighton Rock changed the rules was for UK crime fiction. There's been a kind of unspoken tradition going right back to Agatha Christie and back before her, that you basically, you know, you start with a dead body in a library in chapter one, and the rest of the book is a kind of puzzle to figure out, solve who did it. Graham Greene firstly threw that rule book out the window by having the victim still alive and in peril at the end of chapter one. So turning, if you like, a crime novel, a crime fiction novel, into a crime thriller, and probably the first British crime thriller ever. Secondly, it had one of the most incredible opening lines. It's an opening line that it's such a grabber, you have to read on. And the opening line of Brighton Rock is, within 3 hours of arriving in Brighton, Hale knew they meant to murder him. Kind of, who is Hale? Why is he in Brighton? Who's going to murder him? You know, you have all those elements going on. Thirdly, what Brighton Rock did, that I don't remember any detective novel, any fiction novel, it's not really a detective novel, but any thriller before it, having such a core of morality, you know, at its heart. Brighton Rock is about a 17-year-old gangster called Pinky, who's a monster. He's a teenage. He's in charge of this bunch of middle-aged misfit loser, criminals, all gangsters, but they're all kind of useless. And Pinky is the one who kind of runs the gang. And although he's a killer, he's a devout Catholic, and he's terrified of eternal damnation. So throughout the kind of novel, there is this extraordinary thing of this criminal, but against this sort of religious faith. And it, to me, the book was just so endlessly absorbing, and with this kind of big moral heart. And I remember, and it's got psychologically, I think, one of the darkest, if not the darkest, psychological ending ever written in fiction. And I put that book down way back when I was 14, and I promised myself that one day I'd try and write a book that was set in Brighton and was maybe 10% as good as that one. There's a kind of cliche in the crime fiction world of the cop with the drink problem, the broken marriage, and I wanted to get away from that. And I thought, you know, what detectives do more than anything else is they solve puzzles. And I thought it'd be interesting to create a detective who had a personal puzzle of his own that he could not solve. And that's why in the first Roy Grace in Dead Simple, when we first meet him, we learn that he's got a missing wife, and she's been missing for nearly 10 years. And while he continues to function as an effective homicide detective, you know, he's looking for her constantly. I was going to set the mystery up in book one, and in book two, I was going to resolve it. Dead Simple came out, and I was inundated with emails from fans speculating on what might have happened to Sandy, his wife. And I thought, you know what, I can have some fun with this. So I just kind of kept it going. And it's finally resolved, I think, in Love You Dead, which is two books back. So I kind of carried it through for about 12 books, and people have really had fun with it. And I haven't completely let it go, because there's now a new mystery that's come out of it.
So there you go. That was Peter James with his second Desert Island read, Brighton Rock by Graham Greene. Now, you'll notice that I did ask him a question that you'd had for him, Yvette, which was about his missing wife.
The missing Roy Grace wife. Because that's just actually, for me, became such an important part of reading the series. And yes, I wanted to know what the actual plot of the next book was, but also I wanted to know what was going on.
Because he's quite a few books in now, and I think only a couple of books ago you actually find out what had happened,
and it
started in the first book, didn't it?
Yeah.
What I found funny from that, though, was when he said that fans basically orchestrated their own torture by writing in and asking him over and over again, and then he thought, oh, well, there's mileage in this. So it's their own fault.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really.
No, I love it. Yeah.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So this week on the island we have Emirates Airline Festival of Literature author Peter James. Remember, the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature is happening from the 1st to the 10th of March. Where is it happening, Yvette?
It's happening at the Intercon at Festival City, apart from one event, of course, which is at Dubai Opera. But otherwise, you'll find us there hanging out over two fairly busy weekends.
Hanging out. That makes it sound so relaxed.
Yeah. Is it not about? Is that not your recollection?
No. Lying on a sun lounger doing absolutely nothing, of course. So EmiratesLitFest.com is where you can find out more information about any of the authors that we've talked about today, because we've been talking about festival authors all through the show, and we will be continuing with that until 1 o'clock as well. If you missed it earlier, here's some background on our desert island victim.
Peter James is one of the UK's most treasured crime and thriller novelists. His Roy Grace detective novels have sold over 18 million copies worldwide. His first non-fiction title, Death Comes Knocking, was published in 2016. Three of James's books have been adapted as critically acclaimed plays. He's also produced numerous films, including The Merchant of Venice, starring Al Pacino. He was chair of the Crime Writers Association twice and won the Diamond Dagger Award for sustained excellence 2 years ago. James was also voted by H. Smith readers as the best crime author of all time. Born and brought up in Brighton, he divides his time between his homes in Sussex and Notting Hill in London.
Diamond Dagger, that's a good prize.
It is, I quite like that.
The Dagger Awards make me actually want to become a crime writer, just so I can win an award shaped like a dagger.
Because obviously you'd do that immediately. You became a crime writer. First novel would be in there.
It would be brilliant.
Yeah.
I don't like how you don't believe in me, Yvette, but let's move on.
Oh, sorry. Did that come over in my tone?
Yes, it did, actually.
I'm so sorry. Annabelle, if you wrote a crime novel, you would absolutely win a dagger.
Thank you very much.
That's okay.
So we're going to move on now. So we've had The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris, Brighton Rock by Graham Greene, and this third choice is a classic that's always on the best books of our time lists, Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Peter explains why he loves it so much.
Yeah, I totally did. Slaughterhouse-Five was a book that found me as a confused, like, 20-year-old. Trying to make sense of the world, and it is the most wonderfully humorous book. It's the book I'd want with me on the desert island, because to read it is to smile and to have kind of life re-enhanced. It's so full of, it's a great story, you know, it's the story of an American ophthalmologist called Billy Pilgrim, who's the only survivor of an air disaster. And he's had brain damage, and so while he functions as a very effective, successful, rich ophthalmologist, he finds himself unable to avoid going backwards and forwards to any point in his life at any moment. So one minute he could be in the Normandy landings in France, you know, and another moment he's doing something else. And Kurt Vonnegut has got these lovely sayings that he kind of brings in during the book. The recurring one is "So it goes." But he's got some lovely philosophies, and there's a great one of his, which always makes me smile, and he says, "Listen, kid, we're put on this earth to fart around, and don't let anyone tell you any different." And then a kind of more deep one where he's, "Look, I don't know what's going on, and I guess I'm not smart enough to understand if someone were to explain it to me. I think we're being tested by someone or something that's a whole lot bigger than us, and all I can do is hang around and try and be calm and friendly and have a nice time till it's over."
What do you think? I mean, Slaughterhouse-Five is often up there with, you know, the greatest works of our time. What is it about classic novels that make them great, in your opinion? What makes Slaughterhouse-Five great?
I think one of the things about classic novels is that they, however they serious or however comic they are, they have an underlying seriousness looking at an issue. And Slaughterhouse-Five, the issue is war. And part of the novel is set around the Tsar bombing of Dresden, in which Vonnegut tells us pretty clearly that more people died in the Tsar bombing of Dresden at the end of the war than in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And people tend to forget that. And it is at its heart an anti-war novel. It's about the futility of war, the horror of war, the sadness of war. Yeah, and Billy Pilgrim is one of its survivors. And I think it's a book that always makes you think. And I think great writing makes you think. You know, I think a really good book is a book that engages you, enthralls you, takes you on a journey. And during that journey, at the end of that journey, you're seeing an aspect of the world in a slightly different, enriched way that's going to forever just change something inside you. That, to me, is the definition of a truly great novel.
Kurt Vonnegut passed away a few years ago. Did you ever get to meet him?
No, but I spoke to him. I read Slaughterhouse-Five when I was at film school, and I put the book down. I thought, I want to make this movie. And little schoolboy me, I phoned him. He's in the phone book. I lived on the Martha's Vineyard in Cape Cod, and I phoned him, and he answered the phone. And I told him who I was, and I just read the book and loved it. And he was so charming. He said, "Gee," he said, "you know, I'm all sorry that I stole the movie rights about 2 years back, but I tell you what, kid," he said, "give me your phone number, and if nothing ever happens, I'll phone you back and let you know if the rights become available." He never did phone me back, but it was just an extraordinary moment for like a 20-year-old kid to be talking to this man who, for me, was one of the greatest writers in existence.
That was Peter James with his third Desert Island read, Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. So we've had The Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris, Brighton Rock by Graham Greene, and Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Now, I think that's really lovely that he actually did manage to have a chat with one of his heroes. Because
I know. He must have had that fan moment.
Yeah, must have had that fangirl moment that you're going to have with Floella.
Absolutely.
Just remind everybody, because we've been giving them a brain teaser, haven't we? We've got a few text messages coming in.
Yeah, so my thing to get your brain working this morning, or indeed your Google working this morning, in which county would you find Brighton, where Peter James's Roy Grace novels are all set? Which English county is home to Brighton?
One thing that I want us to talk about, and because you've just reminded me by talking about Brighton and where crime novels are set, is that often these settings for crime series become, over the course of the novels, like a character in their own right. So with Ian Rankin, you've got Edinburgh kind of taking on a life of its own. You've got Ian Rankin's Edinburgh. And with Peter James, you've got Peter James's Brighton. Who do you think has done it the best?
Those two certainly spring to mind, but I think Ian Rankin with Edinburgh, you know, there are places that are visited in the books that are now tourist attractions, and the same with Brighton. I know at one point in Brighton, and maybe you still can, you could do a Peter James tour, so you could go and see all the places that he features. And I think a sense of place, I love books that have that. Also, those that are set in the Shetland Islands, again, really, really strong. So, you know, you've got Anne Cleves, who's writing those. Peter May, who's written the books about Lewis. And the landscape there is so important. That's Lewis the place, just to clarify, not the sidekick to Inspector Morse. Inspector Morse, Oxford, you know, the two become synonymous.
It's almost like you can't separate. That's a brilliant example, because I cannot separate in my head Morse from Oxford.
No.
Morse is Oxford. Oxford is Morse.
Absolutely, and in the same way that, you know, Ian Rankin's creation is Edinburgh, without doubt, and the two are intertwined.
When we had our kind of crime bookshelf discussion a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Anthony Horowitz, Peter James, Shari Lapina, and Mark Billingham, who are all coming to the Literature Festival. And I wondered, because one thing came up, and that's that crime fiction is either the most read genre by women, or it's endlessly popular. And I wondered why. Why do you think crime fiction is so popular? Why do you love it so much?
Evil laugh.
Oh, gosh.
Just gives me loads of ideas, Annabelle. Loads and loads of
suddenly feeling very
interesting ideas. Again, do you know what? It almost goes back to the whole picture book thing of liking to be scared, but you've still got control over it. So, and that, I think, is why I probably enjoy reading more than I enjoy films. Because short of taking my glasses off when I'm watching a particular part of a film that I don't want to see and the screen goes blurry, or wandering off to make a cup of tea if I'm at home, not that I do that because I don't drink tea, but hey, reading a book, I think, you know, you can, like, oh, I'm not enjoying this, I'm just going to flip that page over. So you're totally in control as the reader, and people are probably shocked that I've just admitted that I do occasionally have to skip bits of crime books, but you sort of just get the general idea. It's like, I don't need the more detail, it's fine. Yeah, so I think it's a being scared in a safe space.
I think skipping pages if you're scared is fine. I know somebody who reads the last page of a novel before they begin.
Do you know what? I have done that on occasion.
What?
Because if I think it's going to have a particularly traumatic ending, I have to prepare myself. I have to know in advance. I know. Alan Bell I just so wish you could see her face. We may have to Instagram that.
Oh, my
goodness. Look. So I have done that, just to know. Yeah.
I'm so disappointed.
Are you?
So
great.
Disappointed.
I love disappointing people. It's... But also with crime, I think there's the puzzle aspect as well, and particularly the whodunits. I love classic crime fiction. I love the 1930s classic crime fiction.
You an Agatha Christie fan?
Absolutely.
Well, I have some fun facts for you, because earlier I was talking about authors and their day jobs, and I mentioned Charles Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kurt Vonnegut, who we've just heard Peter James talking about, so he opened the first Saab dealership in the US in 1957.
That is bizarre.
To support his family before his writing career took off, and he was a bit rubbish at his job, which benefited his writing because he didn't have any customers.
Plenty of times, right? That's a great fact. I love that.
And Agatha Christie, you probably know this one if you're a fan, became a nurse during World War One, and later became a hospital pharmacist, which is how she learned so much about poisons.
Yeah, and that features strongly in her book. She's actually got one in particular where the hospital pharmacy plays a great part. Yeah.
because quite a few of her novels involve poison.
The odd poison, yeah.
The odd poisoning.
But those who know me and work with me and so on should always be afraid.
Oh, goodness. This is turning to a very scary episode of Talking of Books. She also saved two lives with her poison knowledge and poison obsession. So another pharmacist inspired her to use a thallium poisoning in her book The Pale Horse, and it has some rather nasty and distinctive side effects, which I won't go into on air. But two patients read her in-depth account in the book, and it led to them being correctly diagnosed for thallium poisoning.
Good grief.
So Agatha Christie really did save lives.
So were they being poisoned by someone then, those people?
I don't know. I have so many unanswered questions.
I know. Oh.
So yeah, Agatha Christie.
Excellent.
Poison expert.
Wonderful. Crime novels with a social conscience.
Yep.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.